muskies. We catch and release them, actually. We hardly ever catch them because we cast and use plugs we made ourselves. I haven't caught one now in... Ben, when did I last catch a muskie? Was it 2 years ago? The man in the front turned. Yeah. No. I think it was 3. We've had a lot of strikes since then, but no boaters. Why? I was just telling the boy about our fishing. Non-fishing, you mean. We never seem to catch anything. The man next to Brian nodded. But we see the country, and that's what it's all about, isn't it? He studied Brian, his eyes questioning. Yes, Brian looked out the window. That's what it's all about. We work the woods all our lives, Ben, the man in front, turned. Cruising for the lumber companies. Living. Just living. We're down in the cities now, but once you've been in the woods, well, you can take the man out of the woods, but you can't take the woods out of the man. We like to get back. Musky fishing is just an excuse. The man next to Brian nodded. It must be the same for you. We heard about you. Saw it all on television back when it happened. You must have got the woods in you then. Brian nodded. It's a wonderful thing, the old man said, looking again out the window. What? To have the woods in you. Young people almost never have it now. You're very lucky. And Brian knew he was right. He'd never felt he was particularly fortunate before, but the old man was exactly right. He was very lucky to have the woods in him and to be getting back to it. I hope you have good fishing, he said, and meant it. And you as well. I hope everything comes to you that you want. Brian smiled and watched the woods and lakes unroll beneath the plane. The droning of the engine made him drowsy, and his eyes closed, then opened again, and he thought, looking across the wilderness half asleep, he thought, Lord, what a wonderful place this is, and knew it was a kind of prayer. The List. Canoe. 17-foot Kevlar, named The Raft, from my time with Derek on the river. With 2 wide wood paddles with glass tips. Repair kit with a piece of glass cloth and epoxy resin. Light life vest flotation device. Straight bow. Wood and glass laminated. 45-pound pull at 26-inch draw. 4 extra strings. 100 cedar arrow shafts, all spine tested for stiffness to match the bow. 60 field points. 50 MA3 broadheads. Nox, pre-cut 4-inch feathers, turkey, not plastic. Glue to make everything. Point cement, small fletcher to put feathers on. Plastic tapering tool to work shafts down to take the points and knocks. He debated long on the arrows, whether to take pre-made arrows or the materials to make them, and in the end did both. He had 2 dozen finished arrows, half broadheads and half field points. Small stone and file to sharpen broadheads. Plain leather quiver to hang down the center of my back. Again, he debated whether to use a standard over-the-shoulder quiver or a center hung with double harness. He decided on the center quiver because his head would protect the arrows and keep them from hitting things when he was moving through the brush. Knife. Plain hunting-style knife with cross hilt and straight 6-inch flat blade, sharpened on one side except for the tip. To be sharpened also on the top, back about 2 inches. A tool and a weapon. Use the same stone and file for sharpening the broadheads to sharpen the knife and hatchet. Hatchet. There were many variations he could have gone with here, as with knives, but he chose a plain belt axe, not unlike the one his mother had given him when he started north the first time. Like the knife, it was always on his belt and would always be there. He had learned that it was much better to have a tool weapon with you and not need it than it was to need one and not have it. Fishing gear. Nothing fancy. 2 spools of braided line, 20-pound test, 12 metal leaders and a container of small sinkers, the kind with the rubber twist center. Small plastic box with 100 assorted fish hooks. No rod, no reel. Just the hooks, line, and sinkers. At this point in compiling the list, a kind of stubbornness had come into Brian's thinking. He had lived before with much less. Just having a modern bow and good arrows and real fishing gear was like being rich. And part of him wanted to just go with that. Maybe throw in a pot for cooking and, of course, some clothes. But he had not been completely idle in the 2.5 years since he'd been lost in the wilderness, as some put it. He had been reading, expanding his knowledge, and most of the reading he'd done had been not about modern survival gurus or people who used high-tech gear to go off for a week or a month and then write a book or do a documentary about it and get rich. He had instead studied the true winners, the people in history who had survived in the wild because they had no other choice. The primitive Native Americans of the past, as well as Inuit, Cree, and even the peoples of the U.S. Southwest, though the terrain in that region was radically different from these North Woods. For them, it wasn't a game, but their lives. What Brian knew now as primitive living had in fact been modern for them. It was how they lived, or died. He read and reread, and in the end decided that if those people had had modern conveniences available, they would have used them, just as they did when new things came along. Very few Native Americans still chipped stone arrowheads to use for hunting, though he suspected some of them still hunted with a bow. Brian decided he would still draw a line. If he went crazy and took everything available—guns, watermakers, special clothing, or gear—he would lose what he had found, the beauty, the connection with the wild that had come into him. So he added carefully to the list. Books. Compact, 2-volume set of the complete works of Shakespeare. Definitive guide, with pictures of edible plants, nuts, and berries of the North Woods. He had come to love reading as much as he disliked television, and he'd chewed on which books to take. They were heavy and could not stand much rough use, and decided to ask Caleb, who in turn had asked him, "Who is the greatest writer of all?" Brian had been stumped until Caleb told him. "Shakespeare. I've never been able to read him." "Well, then now is a good time to start," Caleb said. "And when you do, read aloud." "Even alone?" "It's easier to understand. They're plays, meant to be read aloud. Just try it." He had learned a lot on his own in his time in the woods, sometimes with disastrous results. And he brought the field guide because he wanted to have a wider knowledge of what he could safely eat. Shakespeare for the soul, the guide for the stomach. 3 mechanical pencils with extra lead. 4 small books with blank-lined pages. He didn't usually keep a journal, and he didn't want to lock himself into it now. But he had become very close to Caleb, in some ways closer than he was to his parents, and he thought he could keep a running letter to Caleb, and instead of trying to send him pages and envelopes, he could send the book all at once when he found a way to get it out. Camping gear and supplies. 1 good compass. He thought of taking a global positioning system which relies on satellite signals, but had a distrust of complicated systems, and decided against it. 1 drop of water in the wrong place, or a fall, or dropping it on the rocks, and it was useless. Besides, he would have a good map from the pilot, and every lake was a landmark. 2 decent quality backpacks with external frames. 1 small camp shovel. Here the concept of world politics helped him. The Soviet Union had come apart, and one of the things its crumbling military complex had was surplus titanium. Some enterprising Russian had come up with the idea of making titanium, super light and super strong, camping shovels, and Brian bought one through a catalog. 1 small but good quality 2-man tent, the kind that becomes a dome with a screen entrance. He was not sure how long it would last, probably until the first bear decided to tear it apart, but it would give him a chance to sleep mosquito-free for a while. Sleeping bag, rated to 0 degrees. This was much too warm for a summer bag, but in the back of his mind were the fall and winter nights, the still, deep cold. For now, he could always open the bag and sleep on top of it. 2 aluminum pots, a 2-quart and a 4-quart, with lids, a large metal insulated cup, a 2-quart plastic water container. No frying pan, no oil, no stove. He'd become accustomed to cooking over fire and preferred it. Besides, if he used a cooking stove, he'd have to carry fuel for it, and that was a whole new problem. A container of salt in a plastic bag. He had missed salt a great deal in the bush. 3 boxes sugar cubes in a plastic bag. For his sweet tooth. 3 boxes of 1-gallon zip-closure plastic bags. Tea for several months. 4 plastic bottles vitamin C tablets, and 3 bottles of multiple vitamins. He hadn't had vitamins the first time out, but his mother and Caleb had insisted on it. His mother didn't know Brian would be on his own for a time, perhaps for a long time, but she wanted him to take the vitamins anyway. "Don't those people you're going to visit use vitamins?" "Smallhorns. They are the Smallhorns, Mother, not those people." "Whatever. Surely they use vitamins. You take them." A 25-pound bag brown rice, wrapped in a plastic garbage bag. A roll of 30 plastic garbage sacks to waterproof equipment and packs. In his reading, he'd discovered that most of the cultures in the world seem to exist on rice, and he had started to cook with it at home, though in small amounts. His mother didn't like it. He found it bland but mixable with other foods, and he thought to use it now and then with fish or other meat or wild vegetables. No flour, no bread, no candy, no ingredients for pizza. Caleb had jokingly suggested that one. No ice cream, no soda. None of the things he had come to miss so much when he was in the woods before. They had all proved to be phony pleasures. He neither wanted them nor needed them in his life any longer. A small, basic first aid kit. He couldn't do sutures or treat major wounds with this, but he had filled a prescription for antibiotics to help with any infection he might get. Also, insect repellent. 8 boxes waterproof matches. 3 small propane lighters. He remembered the difficulty of getting a fire going, and while he felt certain he could do it again with just a hatchet and a stone, this was one area where he definitely wanted to go modern. He'd also brought a magnifying glass to look closely at things that might interest him, and he could use it to start fires if the sun was out. Clothing. 2 pairs loose hiking pants. 1 pair of soft hiking shoes. 4 t-shirts. 2 pullover polar fleece jackets. 1 pullover breathable waterproof anorak with a hood. 1 fabric military-style belt to carry the knife and hatchet. 3 pairs athletic socks. 3 pairs hiking shorts with several pockets. 3 pairs briefs. 2 billed caps. 1 sewing kit with assorted needles and 4 spools heavy thread. 1 spool waxed sewing cord with heavy needles. 1 hand-awl needle combination. 3 small cakes beeswax for thread and bowstrings. If it came to it, he wanted to be able to sew leather, especially for moccasins. Hiking shoes were fine, but he had come to like sewn moccasins. They were light, and though they wore out rapidly, he could feel the ground through them and move more quietly. A 10-by-10-foot tarp, 200 feet of inch nylon rope, parachute cord. And an old 3-pound coffee can he found in the water by the plane when they were getting ready to take off from Rainier. Chapter 10. Dear Caleb, I had surprise company today. She didn't stay long, which I'm glad about, but she definitely kept me from being bored. And now he was at last alone. He held the canoe in the lily pads and let the smoke from the small fire in the can blow over him and take the mosquitoes away. There were fish everywhere. Hiding beneath the pads, he could see dozens of bluegills and other panfish. Sunfish, he thought, from the yellow flash of their bellies when they turned suddenly. And now and then, a northern pike, hunting the lilies, would hit them and scatter them. He would take some later, for food, but it was only mid-afternoon, and the plane had just gone. He thought he could still hear the engine, and he had time to move to the end of this small lake before dark, and time to camp. He smiled, remembering the pilot when they'd landed. He had dropped the other 2 men off first. A lighter plane used less fuel, so the 2 of them had been alone for the flight. It had taken 40 minutes or so to fly 100 miles, and the noise of the engine was loud, so they didn't speak much. At one point, the pilot leaned over and yelled, "You sure you'll be all right alone up here?" As right as I've ever been, Brian thought, and was going to yell it, but simply nodded, and that was all their conversation until they landed and taxied to a stop at the end of the lake. "You're here." The pilot took a map from a folder in the back and handed it to Brian. "This little lake is called Payson Lake. You need to work this stream north up to Liberty Lake, and then this series of chain lakes," he unfolded the map, "up to Williams Lake. The Smallhorns are in camp here. They were at the northeast end, but it's a fish camp, and they move around the lake. You can see it's a big lake, I think 8 or 9 miles long, and a couple wide, so you might have to look for them." He gave Brian the map and helped him unload his canoe and put his gear in it. Before doing anything else, still standing on the float of the plane, Brian folded the map so his locale was face up and put it in one of the plastic bags to keep it waterproof. Then he waded ashore. "See you in the fall," the pilot called. He waited until Brian was well away from the plane, then fired up the engine and took off without looking back. Brian had moved at once to the shore of the small lake, pulled the canoe up on a grassy flat area, and repacked his equipment. He tied everything that was loose in the canoe to the cross strut and covered it all with the tarp, except for his bow and the quiver of arrows. If he fell or the canoe rolled, he would not lose all his gear. He strung the bow, made certain the string was properly knocked at both ends, and put it within easy reach on the tarp. It wasn't tied down, but the bow and arrows floated and wouldn't be lost if the canoe rolled over suddenly. It was hot, and Brian stripped to a pair of shorts, taking his T-shirt off and rolling it under the tarp. The life jacket was nearby, but since he would be working near the shore in 3 feet of water and then up a small creek, he didn't feel like wearing it. It was not the safest thing to do, and he would wear it if he started into deep water. But the sun felt so nice on his bare skin that he wanted to be free for a time. For the same reason, he took off his cap and rolled it up in a side pocket on one of the packs. The flies and mosquitoes were bad as he'd ever seen them. But the little whiff of smoke now and then from the can in the bottom of the canoe kept him at bay. He did not hurry. He thought he might never hurry again, and he quickly dropped into what he sometimes thought of as woods time. It wasn't about time so much as about knowing what was happening and where it was happening. He often remembered the wolf he had seen moving through the woods, listening to everything, seeing everything, taking its time to not miss whatever there was to see. Brian did that now. A leaf that moved, a small bit of wind, the cry of a small bird. He breathed slowly, quietly, and paddled the canoe gently along the shore. He saw and heard it all, was as absolutely tuned to the woods as he'd ever been, and so was completely surprised when the deer jumped into the canoe. Chapter 11. Dear Caleb, today I found out about plans and how they don't always work. There was a sudden crash to his side, so fast he hadn't heard any preliminary movement, and a white-tailed doe flew out of the brush to his right. She was a full 8 feet in the air when she left the brush, and billowing from her eyes were clouds of something that resembled smoke. Later, when he had time to think, he decided that flies and mosquitoes were attacking her eyes and she was momentarily blinded. She was trying to make the water where she could put her head under and clear away the bugs. She landed almost exactly in the center of the canoe, nearly in Brian's lap, and she wanted out. Brian had read about a man who had accidentally hit a buck with his station wagon. The deer was knocked sideways and lay still in the ditch. The man stopped. Thinking the deer was dead and not wanting to waste the meat, he put the deer in the back of the station wagon. He'd gone about 4 miles when the deer, which was only stunned, came back to life. The man said it was like a bomb had gone off in the car. To save himself, he opened the door and bailed out with the car still moving. The deer kicked out every window, including the windshield, before it could get out and get away. Something close to that happened now to Brian. The doe landed half on her feet and half on her stomach across the canoe. Her head, which was over the side, went down in the water, and she thrashed around to raise it, probably thinking she was on a log of some kind, to find herself staring directly into Brian's eyes. It was impossible to say who was more surprised. Hey! Brian just had time to start when, with a lunge and a kick, the doe left the canoe. The problem was that her back feet caught the gunwale of the canoe and spun it like a cork. In half a second, Brian went from being upright with not a care in the world, thinking how wonderful and grand everything was, to being upside down, lungs full of water, tangled up in canoe, gear, lily pads, and mud. Oh, he came up screaming and spitting mud and water. What? He still hadn't figured out quite what had happened, but it rapidly became clear as he saw the deer bounding up out of the water and away into the brush on the shore, while he stood waist-deep, surrounded by arrows, bow, upside-down canoe, and packs, still dry, inside garbage bags. Nothing was seriously damaged. Nearby, on shore, was a small clearing 10 or 12 yards across. Brian grabbed the side of the canoe and dragged it up to the shore. He untied the packs and put them on the grass, along with his bow and arrows and the extra paddle. The equipment in the packs had been enclosed in plastic, but he had neglected to wrap his sleeping bag, so it was wet, though not soaked through. It had been in its stow bag, and water seeped in only at the end. Still, it needed to be dried. "Well, I guess," he said, looking around at the clearing, "that's one way to find a camping spot." He flipped the canoe and emptied it, pulled it up on the grass and inverted it again. He spread his sleeping bag in the sun to dry and put his tent up. There were fish in the lily pads, and Brian put the line out with a bare hook, standing in the water up to his waist and fishing out around his legs. The hook was golden and flashed tiny bits of light. The fish bit without bait, and he took half a dozen hand-sized panfish. They were a mix of bluegills and a smaller brownish fish that seemed to be a cousin of a crappie, maybe some kind of rock bass, but they would taste fine. He cleaned and scaled them and put them in the large pan with fresh water. He gathered dry driftwood for half an hour and had plenty for the night. He started a fire and put the fish on one side of the fire, and then he put 1 cup of water in the small pot with 1/2 cup of rice and put it on the other side of the flames. He had not eaten since the night before and would get a full meal for tonight. The fish boiled fast and was done in 15 minutes. The rice took about 1/2 hour. Brian picked the meat off the fish and put it in his metal cup until the rice was done. Then he added the fish and some salt to the rice. He ate with a spoon, cleaned the pot well, then boiled water in the large pot to fill his 2-quart canteen for the next day and furnish him with a cup of evening tea. While the water was boiling, he bear-proofed the camp, or did the best he could. He had read up on bears when he was back in civilization, and knew that above all they were intelligent and unpredictable. To be secure, you had to get rid of all food smells. He buried the fish bones and skin well away from the camp area. He then tied the end of a piece of nylon rope to a stick to give it weight and lobbed it over a limb 30 feet up in a nearby birch. He tied both his packs to the line and pulled them up 15 feet in the air, then snubbed the line off. A smart bear might know to chew the rope off and drop the packs, but he doubted there were many that intelligent around. His sleeping bag was dry, and he put it in the tent, then sat by the fire sipping hot tea with a sugar cube while he checked his bow. The string was well waxed, and the water had not penetrated it. The bow itself was finished with a varnish that was waterproof. The arrows were a different story. They were made of bare wood. He hadn't bothered to paint them or varnish the shafts, and the feathers had become soaked. He checked each shaft carefully to make certain it was still straight, found 2 that were slightly off and bent them gently until they were straight while holding them to the heat. All this knowledge came from books he'd read on old-time archery. He then carefully held each arrow so that heat from the fire dried the feathers without curling them. It was a painstaking process, and he took his time, listening to the crackle of the fire, adding a stick or two now and then, and becoming more and more aware of the night woods around him. The forest was alive, for the woods became more active in the dark. Many predators were nocturnal. It was easier to catch prey then, though many prey animals like mice and rabbits moved in the dark because they felt safer. Brian heard 100 rustlings, rubbings, breaking of small twigs, brushing of hair against leaves. There, he thought, was a squirrel moving through trees, and there was a mouse or a rabbit moving over the forest floor. It was hard to tell them apart. Suddenly he heard a scream, far off, as a rabbit was caught and died. It sounded almost human, baby-like, very much like the sound a baby doll makes when it is tipped over. He heard it twice, and then the rabbit was gone, into a wolf or fox or skunk or weasel, perhaps even an owl. Rabbits and mice were the bottom of the food chain in the woods. Everybody ate them. And he heard screams twice more. 3 dead rabbits. As he held an arrow to the heat, he let his mind play with the numbers. 3 dead rabbits in an hour. He could probably only hear them scream from a couple of hundred yards, say a quarter of a square mile around him, which meant that perhaps 6 rabbits an hour were killed in every square mile of wilderness at night. And yet there were still hundreds, thousands of rabbits running loose, so many that in winter they left small highways packed so hard they would hold a human up on the snow. He shook his head. Wasted thought. There were rabbits. They were good to eat. He had eaten many of them. He would eat many more. It was enough. It was late, and the moon was up. When he finished drying the arrows and quiver, he put the fire out and took his weapons and bow into the tent. He was suffering a kind of jet lag, the shock of coming from civilization to the bush, and he was very tired. He crawled into his bag, arranged the knife and hatchet and bow and arrows near his head, and leaned back and down to sleep. It was a few minutes coming. He lay listening to the woods, thinking of the day. He hadn't planned to camp here. On the map, it was only a few miles to the next lake, and he'd thought to go there before camping. But the doe had come along and changed all his plans. She had picked the campsite for him, he thought, smiling as sleep came over him, and he closed his eyes and let the day slip away. Chapter 12. Dear Caleb, today I saw a place that was so beautiful that I don't think even Shakespeare could describe it. The map showed a series of small lakes covering perhaps 30 miles. In between, from lake to lake, there appeared to be a meandering river, all of it equally divided, so that a lake might be 3 or 4 miles long, then the river to the next lake another 3 or 4 miles. But Brian was to find that the map wasn't accurate. He awakened just after dawn, when the sun began to warm the tent. The sky was cloudless. He flipped the canoe, and when he went to lower his packs, he saw the bear tracks. One bear, medium size. It had come in the night so quietly that Brian hadn't heard it. Though he had slept so soundly, the bear could have been tipping garbage cans. It had done no damage. The tracks went by the fire, then moved to where he'd buried the fish leftovers. The bear had dug them up and eaten them. It had moved to the tent, apparently looked in on him, then gone to the packs. Brian could see that it had tried to stand and reach them. There were claw marks on the tree, but the bear had never figured out the rope holding the packs and had gone off without doing anything destructive. "Company," he said, "and I didn't even wake up." He slid the canoe into the water at the edge of the lake and loaded all his gear, again tying everything in. He took time to gather some bits of wood and leaves for a smudge in the can, then jumped in. It was still early, but already warm, and he quickly stripped down to shorts. He kept the map in its clear plastic bag jammed beneath a rope in front of him. He knelt to paddle instead of sitting on the small seat because it felt more stable. He was not as confident in the canoe as he wished to be. He'd taken it to a small lake near home to practice and rented canoes in other places, but the ease with which the doe had flipped him made him very conscious of the fact that he had much to learn. By staying low and on his knees, he had much more control. He sat toward the rear, with the load tied in slightly forward of the middle, which kept the canoe nearly level and easy to steer and control. He studied the map as he paddled. He had only a mile to go in the present lake, and then he would enter the river. He had the compass in one of the packs, but didn't truly need it. The lakes were well drawn on the map, and he could see where the river flowed out. Except that it wasn't a river. Brian worked easily to the end of the lake, but when he came to the point where the river was supposed to flow out, he found that there was no current. Instead of a series of different lakes connected by small rivers, the land was level and flat. It was all just one long lake, and the very narrow portions that showed on the map as rivers really were long, tranquil ponds. They were so narrow that the trees had grown together over them, and Brian found himself paddling through a green wonderland. The water was absolutely still beneath the trees. He could see his reflection ahead of him and off to the side, so distinct it was as if he were gliding over a mirror. And the water was clear. On both edges were lily-pad forests, and beneath them he could see where schools of panfish lay hidden. Inside of half an hour, he saw a muskie that had to be 30 or 40 pounds, hunting the edges of the pads. Overhead, the trees were filled with birds, and they sang all at the same time. The sound blended into a kind of music, and Brian found himself humming with it as he paddled. Halfway through the first of the long covered passageways, he came upon a cow moose. She was well off to the side and had her head completely underwater, pulling at lily pad roots. As Brian came up on her, gliding silently, she raised her head suddenly and seemed to stare directly at him. Brian had run into difficulties in the past with moose. He thought they were insane, and he'd been attacked by them twice. He laid the paddle down softly and took up his bow. He had kept one of the broadheads lying across the pack by the bow. Moving slowly, he fitted the arrow to the string, so if need be he could grab the bow and get at least one arrow into the moose if she charged. He passed not 20 feet from her, but all she did was keep chewing on the root, water dripping in golden drops from her muzzle, breaking the surface like jewels. It was as though she hadn't seen him, and perhaps she hadn't. Moose, he had read, had terrible eyesight, and she may have thought he was merely a log drifting by. Before he had passed by, she had put her head beneath the surface again, looking for more roots. Brian went back to studying beauty. All that day he felt as if he were in a painting, a beautiful private diorama. He worked through a sheltered narrow lagoon and then out into the open to cross a small lake, then back under the canopy through the still water. He had never had a day pass so quickly nor so beautifully, and he nearly forgot that he had to find a camp and get some food before dark. He wasn't sick of boiled fish and rice yet, so in the late afternoon he took time to move back along the lily pads and drop the hook over. He caught a large sunfish immediately, again on a bare hook, and took 3 more small ones, dropping them all over the side using a short piece of nylon rope as a stringer, running the nylon through their gills and out their mouths. He took his time looking for a campsite and picked one on a flat area 5 or 6 feet above the surface of the lake. It was a clearing about 20 yards across. There were many such clearings, probably all made by beaver cutting down the small trees years before, allowing the grass to take over. Brian pulled the canoe well up onto the grass and, for no real reason, tied a piece of line from the boat's bow to a tree. Later he would wonder at this bit of foresight. He had not done it the night before, and since this site was much higher from the water, he wouldn't have thought he'd need to secure the canoe here. The storm hit in the middle of the night. Chapter 13. Dear Caleb, nothing much to report today, unless you count shooting yourself in the leg with an arrow. It was not that there was so much wind, certainly not as much as he'd been through before with the tornado when he was first marooned in the wilderness, and not that there was so much rain, although there was a goodly amount of it. It was the combination of the two. He had cooked dinner and eaten, boiled water for the next day's canteen, pulled his packs up in a tree, set up the tent, and arranged his sleeping bag and weapons. Then he'd sat by the fire and written to Caleb about the day in one of the books, using tiny writing so he wouldn't waste the pages. When he was done, he put the book back in a plastic bag and crawled inside the tent to go to bed. 2 things he noted but didn't pay attention to. 1, the mosquitoes and flies were not as bad as they'd been. 2, with darkness, a heavy cloud layer had come up, causing a closeness in the air. He had studied the map. It looked as if he'd gone more than 20 miles, which explained why he was tired. About 80 miles remained to reach Williams Lake, maybe 4 more days at his current rate. He fell asleep almost as soon as he lay down. He was awakened by a new sound, a loud sound. Not thunder. It never did thunder or lighten. And not the train-like roar of a tornado. This just started low, the hissing of rain driven against the tent. He listened for a moment, then snuggled back in his bag. He was in a good shelter, waterproof. Let it rain. Except that it kept coming and kept coming. It went from a moderate rain to a downpour, and finally to an outright deluge. And with the rain came wind, not violent, but enough to break off branches and push the rain still harder, and soon Brian found his bag wet as the rain came in under the tent. He lifted the flap to look out, but it was far too dark to see anything. And it rained harder and harder. The wind pushed stronger and still stronger, and at last the tent seemed to sigh. It collapsed around him, and he started rolling across the grass toward the edge of the clearing. Everything was upside down, crazy. He couldn't find the entrance, and about the time he thought he had it, the tent dropped off the 5-foot embankment, and he rolled down to the lakeshore. He landed in a heap and felt an intense hot pain in his right leg at the upper thigh, and reached down to feel an arrow shaft protruding from his leg. Great, he thought, I've shot myself in the leg. He hadn't, of course, but had rolled onto an arrow that had fallen out of the quiver just as the tent rolled off the embankment. He couldn't get his bearings, but he knew where his thigh was, and he grabbed the arrow and jerked the shaft out of his leg. There was an immediate surge of pain, and he felt like passing out. He didn't, but then he heard a strange whump, thump, and something crashed down on his head. This time, he did pass out. He came to a few seconds later with a sore head, a sore leg, and absolutely no idea in the world what was happening to him. He was still wrapped in the tent, and his bag was in his face, and his bow and arrows lay all around him, and he seemed to be in water, almost swimming. All right, he thought. Take one thing at a time, just one thing. I poked my leg with an arrow. There, good. I pulled the arrow out. My leg still works. It must not have been a broadhead because it didn't go in very deep. Good. My tent collapsed. There, another thing. I'm in the tent, and it collapsed. I just have to find the front zipper and get out and climb up the bank. Easy now. Easy. Something hit me in the head. What? Something big that thunked. The canoe. The wind picked up the canoe and it hit me. There, I've poked my leg, rolled down a bank, and been hit in the head with the canoe. All simple things. All fixable things. He fumbled around and at last found the zipper at the front of the tent, opened it, and slithered out into the mud on the lakeshore. The rain was still coming down in sheets, the wind still hissing and slashing him with water, but he had his bearings, and it was not impossible to deal with things. He dragged the tent back up the embankment onto the grass, limping as the pain in his leg hit him. It was too dark to see much, but he could make out the shape of the canoe lying upside down. It had moved a good 10 feet from where he had left it, and had he not tied it down loosely with the line, it would have blown away across the lake. He had forgotten the most important thing about living in the wilderness, the one thing he'd thought he would never forget. Expect the unexpected. What you didn't think would get you, would get you. Plan on the worst and be happy when it didn't come. But he had done one thing right. He had tied the canoe to a tree. He dragged the tent to the canoe, crawled underneath, and lay on the tent the rest of the night, listening to the wind and rain, wincing now and then with the pain in his leg, and feeling stupid. It was a long night. Chapter 14. Dear Caleb, I read some Shakespeare today. I think it changed my life. It was a repair day, both for equipment and for himself. Dawn was wet and dreary, and it took him a full hour to find some dry wood and leaves and get a decent fire going, all the time castigating himself. Had he forgotten everything? He hadn't made a secure camp, hadn't dug a rain gutter around the tent, hadn't brought in wood so he'd have dry fire starter in the morning. He limped through the woods around the campsite until he found a dead birch log with the bark still intact. Birch bark was nearly waterproof. It was what Native Americans used for canoes, and beneath the bark he broke off slivers of dry wood. He took a double armful of bark and slivers back to the campsite, and after 3 attempts, he should have needed only 1 match, he told himself, he at last got a sputtering flame going. Once the bark caught, it went like paper dipped in kerosene, and the wood caught, and when the flames were going well, he put on smaller pieces of the wet firewood. The flames dried the wood and started it burning, and in another 30 minutes he had a good blaze going. He took a moment then to examine his leg. There was a clean puncture wound, not more than 1/2 inch deep, and he took some disinfectant from the first aid kit and dabbed it on the hole, put a Band-Aid on it, and then went back to work. The wind had dropped and the rain had eased to a few sprinkles now and then. He saw clear holes in the clouds. He spread the gear to dry, tying it to limbs with nylon cord. His sleeping bag was soaked through and the tent was a sloppy mess. He had to stay put, so he set the tent back up, this time pegging it down and using the small shovel to dig a drainage ditch around the sides with a runoff ditch leading down to the lake. The wind had tangled the packs in the tree limbs, but they were still intact, and after some effort, Brian untangled them and lowered them to the ground. Again he dried arrows in the quiver and checked his bow. Then he launched the canoe and took about 15 minutes to catch 6 good-sized bluegills. He cleaned the fish, put them on to boil with a teaspoon or so of salt, put rice in the other pan, and then suddenly found that all the work was done. The sun was out. He could actually see steam coming up from his sleeping bag as it dried, and he lay back on the ground by the fire and went over what had happened. His leg throbbed in time with his thoughts as he learned yet again. Never assume anything. Expect the unexpected. Be ready for everything all the time. And finally, no matter what he thought would happen, nature would do what it wanted to do. He had to be part of it, part of what it was really like, not what he or some other person thought it should be like. He gathered wood for the night and spread it in the sun to dry, took the meat off the fish and mixed it with the rice and set it aside to cool. He sometimes liked to eat the rice cold and lay in the sun nude, his shorts drying on a limb, and let the smoke from the fire keep the mosquitoes off while he dozed, catching up on sleep he'd lost in the rain the night before. He slept solidly for more than 4 hours. The fire was nearly out when he awakened, and he put more wood on the coals and got them going again. It was mid-afternoon, and he ate the rice and fish, then made tea and had a cup with a sugar cube for dessert. By evening his bag was dry. He put it in the tent, put on a t-shirt because he was feeling a bit sunburned, and his hand bumped one of the Shakespeare volumes. So I'll try reading it. He had been exposed to Shakespeare in school, briefly, and had not paid much attention. The play they had read was Romeo and Juliet, and he knew it was about young people, so he tried it again now. He stood on the shore and read aloud, and felt silly at first. But because he liked Caleb and trusted him, he kept going, staggering on until he came to the verse in Act 2, where Juliet says, "O Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo? Deny thy father and refuse thy name. Or if thou wilt not, be but sworn, my love, and I'll no longer be a Capulet." Here a strange thing happened to Brian. Whenever he'd heard this part before, on television, in school, he'd thought she was looking for Romeo, wondering where he was, calling for him. But something brought the words, the meaning to him as he stood there in the afternoon sun, reading it aloud out onto the lake, and he knew that was wrong. Knew that she was instead calling on Romeo, asking him why he was a member of the wrong family, the Montagues, and if only he weren't. And a few lines later he read Juliet saying, "What's in the name? That which we call a rose by any other word would smell as sweet." And Brian knew. It was as if his whole world had suddenly opened. He knew what Shakespeare was trying to tell him. Of Juliet's love for Romeo, of her torment and despair over the agony of the fight between the two families. This man had written of these things hundreds of years before Brian was born, in a world so different from Brian's it might be on another planet. And Brian knew. It shook him, standing there on the side of a lake in the northern wilderness, reading a love story written more than 300 years earlier, to know how they felt, how they hurt. He closed the book and sat down on the grass, his legs crossed, the sun heading into evening, and thought of all the time he had wasted not knowing Shakespeare, and a tear slid down his cheek. A tear for Juliet and Romeo. A tear for Shakespeare, who he wished were still alive. A tear for his own loss, and a tear for the beauty of knowing sadness. Chapter 15. "Dear Caleb, it gets more and more beautiful. I think most of the city is leaving me." He was not sure what, if anything, awakened him. probably the fact he had slept so hard during the day. Whatever the reason, in the dead middle of the night his eyes suddenly snapped open and he sat up, listening with his mouth open, breathing in shallow pulls to not make noise. Nothing. He leaned forward and unzipped the tent and looked out. Still nothing. At least nothing to hear. But the sight that met his eyes made him hold his breath. The sky was clear, filled with stars, and the moon was half full and laid a silver streak across the lake, a white road that came across the water and called to him with such intensity that he closed the tent and moved to the canoe, turned it over and slid it out onto the water. The night was cool enough that the mosquitoes stayed down. He stroked once with the paddle and the canoe slid out and away from the bank into the silver reflection of the moon, out on the water. Another pull, another slide across the still water, moving through liquid silver. A loon called. It seemed to come from somewhere to the left, but the sound moved around until it filled the lake, mixed somehow with the moonlight, and became almost visible. It hung there, the sound he could see in the moonlight, for half a minute. Then the loon called again, or another answered it, and suddenly, close on the far edge of the lake, only 100 yards away, a wolf howled. Long, sweet, and sad, and happy, and frightening, and joyful all at once, a keening howl that started high and dropped low and ended almost hoarse. The hair went up on the back of Brian's neck, and he took a deep breath and answered the howl, trying to match the tones of it, starting high the same way and bringing it down as low as he could until it trailed off. Then he waited. 10 seconds, 20, a full minute, and the wolf called again, different this time, low all the time, almost a moan. And Brian answered. 3 more times they went back and forth, and finally Brian waited until the wolf started its call, and Brian matched it, harmonized with it, and they sang together that way, 4 more songs, a duet, boy and wolf in the moonlight, singing to beauty until at last the wolf grew tired of it and quieted. Brian called 2 more, but when he didn't get an answer, he stopped. The moon was dropping below the horizon at any rate, and he paddled back to the campsite, pulled the canoe up, tied it off, and went back into bed. He did not sleep at first, but lay thinking of the wolf and the moonlight and the loon, and when he closed his eyes and sleep started to come, he thought he could see the wolf, or perhaps see as the wolf, moving through the night, part of the night, the smells and sounds of the woods moving through the wolf like vapor, stopping to listen, moving on in a silent slide through the moonlight and forest, Brian and the wolf mixed, Brian Wolf, Wolf Brian, then sleep. He awakened completely refreshed, having slept again past dawn. It was a clear morning, and the side of the tent was warm from the sun, and he rolled out and stretched and walked to the canoe to flip it over and slide it into the water when he saw the prints. 2 wolves had come into camp, one good size, the other slightly smaller, and from the look of the tracks around the tent in the drainage ditch, around the canoe in the soft earth, and beneath the packs, they had investigated everything. They had also peed on the canoe in the tent, not a great deal, but enough so he'd know they had, a calling card, and then moved on. Brian smiled. Either they were greeting him, or, more likely, telling him he was a lousy singer. He finished packing the canoe and just before leaving went up and covered the 2 places where they'd left sign with his own. "Hello to you, too," he peed. Then he got into the canoe and slid off. He had not gone a mile when he was back beneath the canopy, in the green world, and wondered how far it was to the next lake. On the map, that lake was long, almost 8 miles before he would come to his first portage, about a half mile to the next lake, which was at least 6 miles long. He thought perhaps he would do the 2 of them today, which would bring the distance to Williams Lake down to about 65 miles. The canopy only lasted 3 or 4 miles, and he came out onto the 8-mile lake. There was a slight breeze coming up, directly into his face, so he put on the life jacket and set to the paddle, heading right up the middle of the lake. The work felt good, solid somehow. The pain in his leg was nearly gone, and he was just noodling along, paddling the canoe across small lakes and down the green corridors, not really working, and it felt good to stretch his arms and bite deep with the paddle and take the wind. He kept up a steady effort and seemed to be moving well, an illusion caused by the visual effect of the wind blowing small waves in the opposite direction that he was going, but it took him 4 hours to make the 8 miles. "I guess the wind must be stronger than it looks," he said, gliding into the calm area at the end of the lake where the portage started. Half a day gone. He pulled the canoe up on the bank and considered the situation. He had to carry everything half a mile, and he couldn't do it all at once. He tied the tent inside the canoe near the center, and under the cross thwarts he tied the paddles, centering their weight, and the bow and the quiver of arrows. There was a yoke for portaging built into the canoe, shaped to fit around the neck and rest on the shoulders. He put one backpack up in a tree on a bear-proof rope, and the other one he slipped onto his back. Then he moved to the canoe, flipped it belly up and moved beneath it and took the weight of the yoke on his shoulders. At first it felt as if his legs would sink into the ground, but the canoe balanced well, and when he started off he gained a momentum that kept him going. It only took him 20 minutes to walk the portage. There wasn't a trail, the grass had grown up and covered any tracks, but there was a long clearing, and in the dim past somebody had taken an axe and cut marks in the trees to show the direction. Probably, Brian thought, Native Americans when they trapped through here. The axe marks were very old, healed over, and often nearly covered with bark, so some were just a dimple. Still, it meant people had been here before, and it made Brian wonder about them. 50 years ago, he thought, or maybe more, 75. The trees were huge pines, the marks well off the ground. Whoever had made them was probably gone now, dead, nothing left but his mark. He left the canoe at the next lake, tied the pack up in a tree, though he hadn't seen any signs of bear, and carrying the bow with an arrow ready and the quiver on his back, he went back for the other pack. It took him only 10 minutes to get back. He let the pack down, took the quiver off his back, and put the pack back on, and with the quiver in one hand and the bow with a broadhead knocked to the string in the other, he started for the canoe. He hadn't taken 3 steps when he saw the deer. It was a buck, horns in velvet, and it stopped, a young animal with a small rack. Good meat, Brian thought, really good meat. The thought came automatically, and he lowered the quiver to the ground softly, raised the bow, and paused. The deer wasn't 30 feet away and seemed entirely unafraid standing there. While Brian watched, it actually turned its head away and looked to where a bird had chattered on a limb. It would have been an easy shot, a clean shot. "You're mine," Brian thought, and his throat seemed to choke with it, the excitement. Mine. The arrow was in the bow. He raised the bow, drew the arrow, sighted it so he was looking over the broadhead straight at the deer's heart, and then he paused again. He eased the string up and lowered the bow. Maybe in the fall. He could not keep the meat in the hot weather. He would get 3 or 4 meals and the rest would spoil. The skin wouldn't make leather and most of the meat would be wasted. He had fish, all the fish he wanted, all he would need. He could take a rabbit or a grouse for different meat, but not the deer. Not now. It would be a waste. "Thank you," he said aloud to the deer, to whatever hunting spirit was watching over him, had given him this chance at meat. "Thank you." The sound of his voice startled the buck, but still it stood for another beat, 2, 3. Then it turned and trotted off down the portage trail for 30 or 40 yards before springing lightly off to the side. "Thank you," Brian whispered, watching it leave. Chapter 16. "Dear Caleb, I met a man today, and he helped me find my medicine." The deer was on his mind when he came to where he'd left the canoe. He looked out at the lake ahead of him. The wind had picked up a bit, still on his nose, and he would be lucky to make the other end by dark. For a moment, standing there looking at the water, he actually thought, "I'm behind schedule," and then remembered He had no schedule. He was there to learn, to seek, to find, to know. It could happen here or over there or by going backward. There was no time requirement. He thought of the deer again, and the thought made him think of meat other than fish. He was suddenly hungry, and he decided to make camp at the portage and hunt for a grouse or a rabbit to make a rice stew, something heavier than fish. He tied the canoe off to a tree high above the lake, pulled his packs up in the air, found firewood enough for the night, and though it was no longer cloudy, he stacked a pile of wood beneath the canoe to stay dry so he could start a fire if it did rain. Then he hunted. He put the quiver on his back again, took the broadhead off the bow and put it back in the quiver, and because he was taking small game, he pulled out a field point. They were sharp, but had curved shoulders to cause shock and a faster death than the cutting edge of a broadhead, and laid the arrow on the bow. He slipped into the woods. He was wearing tennis shoes and wished he had moccasins, but they would have to serve. The green grass kept his feet quiet enough. One step, another, slowly into the thick green. A yard, another yard, 10 yards. He didn't have to worry about getting lost because he kept the lake on his left, visible now and then through the leaves. He saw a rabbit almost at once and could have hit it easily enough, but that would have ended the hunt, and he was moving now, into the woods, slowly, like a knife being pulled through water, the forest closing back in on him, his eyes seeing every movement, his ears hearing every rustle. "This," he thought, "is what I have become, a hunter." The need to hurry disappeared. The need to kill was not as important as the need to see all there was to see, and he worked the afternoon away until evening, perhaps 2 hours before dark. He had seen 7 or 8 rabbits, any one of which he could have had, and heard several grouse, and seen 4 more deer, 2 of which he could have hit easily. But he had waited. And now as he turned back, a grouse jumped up in front of him, its wings thundering, and flew to a limb on a birch about 25 feet away. Now it was time. He raised the bow, drew the arrow back, looked down the wooden shaft, and saw, felt where the arrow would hit, and released all in one clean, fluid motion. The arrow went where he was looking, took the grouse almost in the exact center of the body, drove it back off the limb, and it fell, flopping for a moment in the grass beneath the tree. "Thank you," Brian whispered as it died, "for the food. Thank you." He picked the bird up, pulled the arrow out, and wiped it on the grass, then tied the grouse to his belt with a short piece of nylon cord and started back. He was done hunting now, but kept the bow ready, the arrow on the string. It was nearing dusk. The sun was well below the line of trees, though it was still light, and he had much to do. Set up the tent, make a fire, cook dinner, and write in the journal. And he picked up the pace and was near where he'd left the canoe, still in thick trees, when he smelled the smoke. He stopped. It was pine smoke. He couldn't see it or hear anything, but there was a definite odor of smoke. It went away, then returned when he moved. How could there be fire? There was no storm, no lightning, which Brian had read caused most forest fires. And besides, with the recent rain, it wasn't likely there would be a forest fire. Still, it was there, again. He moved forward a few steps, stopped, and started to step again when he heard a clink of metal on stone. Somebody was there, ahead, at the camp. Brian crouched and moved again, one step at a time, carefully, quietly, until he was at the edge of the forest. He moved a limb aside and peered out. A man sat crouching with his back to Brian. There was another canoe pulled up by Brian's, an old fiberglass standard 12-footer with many hard miles on it, judging by its look. The man had pulled up more wood and had a fire going and a pot of water boiling. Brian could see the steam. There was no weapon showing, no other gear. Just the canoe tipped upside down and the man and the fire. The man had long gray hair streaked with black. No hat, but a headband, and had his hair tied into a ponytail. All that Brian saw without moving, without speaking.
"You might as well come in by the fire," the man said without looking. "I ain't that much to look at, and I've got potatoes boiling with an onion. We can add that grouse you've got and have some stew.
Brian jumped. The voice was old, gravelly, but it carried so that it seemed to come from everywhere. He realized he still had the bow raised, not aimed.